Thank you, Noah. All right, so we're continuing our study this morning as we move into Lesson 6 of our workbook, the Harmony of the Gospel study that we're doing over the course of this year. And I wanted to just remind us, and I'm fine with kind of doing this just periodically, that, you know, one of the suggestions I had about the way to remember this is in seven different periods. And interestingly enough, the lesson that I get to cover this morning changes from one period to another. So I wanted to kind of point that out again to you. You'll remember that this is the seven periods of the life of Christ. And we have been studying up to this point the first 30 years of his life, which was the preparation, the birth of Jesus, his growth into a man, his introduction to the world through John the Baptist as his forerunner, and then coming into the world on his own and beginning to do his work, choosing his disciples and making himself known. And at that point, we make the transition from making preparation for his ministry to beginning his ministry, but in relative obscurity that not everybody knows about him. The whole point, really, of the first year is to begin to expose himself to people all over the nation of Israel so they begin to know who he is and start seeking after him. You may remember on your chart, and hopefully you have those in your book to keep referring to, that this period of preparation covered about 30 years. And so we're down from the birth of Christ up to about AD 26 or 7, somewhere in there. And we've been studying these passages. We've passed through one Passover that we know of because he was 12 years old. And when they went to the Feast of the Passover, Jesus was lost from his parents and then was recovered. And that was a time of Passover. And we learned that they went every year to that. So Jesus has been to Jerusalem many times for the Passover as he grew up. But this time, we're starting his ministry, starting the things that he'll be doing to make himself known. And immediately after that, we come to one of the first Passovers that he deals with in his life. And we call this period the period of obscurity. And it'll run through several scriptures for us, several lessons that we'll cover in this book. I did make one adjustment on this. I moved the word Passover down just a little bit from what I have on your printed copy, and you might want to consider doing that yourself. Just move it a little bit, because it's John chapter 2 and verse 13 that mentions the Passover, and so I might feel like I have that just a little high on the chart, and if you want to make that note to move it down just a little bit, this on the screen is corrected. So that brings us to lesson 6. It's titled the First Miracle, and I put it in the realm of the period of obscurity as we change from the preparation to the period of obscurity. If you would look with me, do you have the song handy or the poem, I guess, in the back of your book? The poem or the song, either one, it has the same words. The first section is about the preparation. It says, first is the preparation from birth to baptism by John. 30 long years this period ran. He's our example, boy and man. Second period's obscurity. The first year of preaching here we see. The first year of his great ministry, Judea was where he loved to be. Now, we're going to see him move in and out of Judea, of course, but the primary areas that he'll be in and out of Judea. He travels to Jerusalem quite a bit during this first year, making himself known to the leaders and the people, as there is more of a populace in that area than there is in Galilee. But he does have work in Galilee, and that's kind of where we start this morning. Anybody have a thought or comment about that as an introduction? Okay. So let's move into just a brief review, because we're looking at John chapter 1 this morning, or 2 is where we'll pick up, but I want to just briefly look at the background of John 1 that Randy just covered for us. And notice on this chart how that he left Nazareth, where he was living, where he was born and raised. Where he lived after he was born. And he was raised up under Mary and Joseph. He left Nazareth at about 30 years old and traveled down to Bethany, here on the other side of Jordan. And what happened in Bethany? He baptized. He met John the Baptist, who was doing work there, and he was baptized. All right? Immediately after he was baptized, we learned about this in a couple of the other Gospels. What happened to him following his baptism? Yes, he was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Now, that's not recorded in the book of John. That's recorded in the other Gospels here. But we see that track, which is why that line goes over there to the wilderness of Judea. This is where David would have run to when he was running from Saul and he ended up over in, we know that Qumran was over there, in Gedi is where one of the places David runs to. So this is a barren place, and people still don't live in that area. And Jesus was able to stay out here for 40 days and 40 nights, fasting and praying to God, preparing himself for his ministry, and then was tested by Satan. All right, and then after 40 days in the wilderness, he returns back into that local area there and chooses his first disciples with his intention of returning back to Galilee. You look at John chapter 1 and verse 43, after Peter and Andrew had been chosen to come with him, then verse 43 says, the day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee. And there he found Philip and told him to follow him. Philip found Nathanael. And so he begins to get his first disciples with him. And ironically, where are these men from? Galilee. Peter and Andrew and Philip are all of Bethsaida, interestingly enough. And so it's interesting that they kind of came together. Nathanael is from Cana, we learn about in John chapter 21. We'll talk more about that later. All these men that he chose way down here are from Galilee. Can you take a guess? Is there an educated guess of why they're here? I think so. I think that's a good explanation of it anyway. There may have been activities going on. This wasn't a Passover time yet. That's coming up shortly. But these men are interested in spiritual things. They're intrigued by messages from God that they can identify. And John the Baptist was interesting to them. As a matter of fact, we know that there were a couple of disciples who were identified. One was Andrew, who was actually following John and stayed with him for a while to hear the teaching that he was making. And it kind of implies that there were a couple of others, maybe even John the Apostle as well was one of the ones unnamed, but among them, because that's consistent with the way John presents himself in the gospel. So then he returns back to Galilee, and where is the first place that he goes? Not back to Nazareth yet. He has somewhere to be. Cana of Galilee. All right, and why are they going up there? Yeah, there's a wedding to attend, and his mother is going there. Let's notice a little bit of this area here. So when Jesus was in Nazareth, this is this area right up here around the Sea of Galilee. This is a blow-up of it. And when he was in Nazareth, there are several cities that might be called Cana, but I will tell you that this is the most common place that I see. This area, this general direction and distance from Nazareth is the most common that I ever see on maps. But I have learned since then that there are actually several towns that claim to be this Cana. They're all still generally in this area. They have to be in Galilee. But this seems to be the most common one, and it really does kind of fit with the storyline and why maybe Jesus' family is associated with this wedding that's going to go on in Cana. If this is it, then it's about 5 or 6 miles there. Your book mentioned that it took them about 3 hours to travel between Nazareth and Galilee. I have to tell you, I was struck by that immediately because I don't know how many of you know where the old River Chase Middle School is over here. But if you know where that is, you'll have an idea of how far it is from, say, Pelham High School, which I lived in a neighborhood just down the hill from Pelham High School. Not right at it, but the neighborhood out from there. We used to be able to walk home. I did that several times. I walked home from River Chase Middle School to my house. We went through neighborhoods. We went through some property a friend of mine owned. Walked down Valleydale Road. I think it's called Helena Highway now. Is that right? Helena Road. It used to all be Valleydale Road through there, down to Pelham High School. And it used to walk down a little ways, and then I cut through Chandelier with a couple of other friends of mine. We went through, and it took me about an hour, maybe an hour and 5 minutes or so, when I just regularly walked. I wasn't running. Didn't run. And about an hour and 5 minutes, and it was right at 4.7 miles to 5 miles, somewhere in there. So when they said here from Nazareth to Cana is about 5 or 6 miles, and it took them 3 hours, why might that be? Didn't have nearly the paved roads that we had. It was the terrain, Michael. I completely agree with you. This was not interstate highway running through Nazareth to Cana and back. You know, this is not open walkways. It was through mountainous regions. And these are the foothills of the Hermon's Mountain up there, Mount Hermon. And so there's a lot of rough terrain. And so it took a while to walk these different areas.
Bob?
Yes. And the more people you have, the slower it goes, and that kind of thing. Yes, exactly. Someone, okay. Yeah, an entourage. So Jesus was traveling alone, might have been able to cover a lot of ground. But they were traveling together a couple of times. He has his mother with him. She's older. She's not old. Mary was young when she had Jesus, and it's only been 30 years. I'm not sure she's 50 years old yet. So she maybe get around just fine. But she's not an 18-year-old either. And so they watch for each other and take care of each other. So somewhere around 3 hours or so is what the book suggested it might have taken. As he got back into Galilee, they go straight to Cana to do that. His mother, Jesus, was there. The mother of Jesus was there. But it says what in verse 2 about Jesus? I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Were invited. Yes, they were called to come to the wedding. And I noted that this is not just an open community event. It seems like they were specially invited to be there. Jesus and his disciples said, yes, please come and join us at the wedding. Now, they usually had big groups at a wedding like this. If you've ever seen Fiddler on the Roof, you know that the Jewish community loves to kind of turn out for this kind of thing. But it was still people that they knew who knew people they knew. It wasn't just open to the public to come in and out. And so Jesus and his disciples were invited to come to this marriage feast. Please. Okay. Jillian said the same thing. Yes. Very much so. Jillian had the same exact thought, and although it does not say that at all, the implication of her responsibility seems like she's involved. And the first verse says that she was there. So she's kind of maybe gone ahead, and she's there, perhaps preparing, certainly involved to some degree, more so than just the Jesus and his disciples who are called to come and be a part of it. So I agree. There is some significance to her responsibility or her involvement in this particular wedding. Jillian really wants to think it's one of Jesus' sisters was getting married. But I said, well, honey, you're going to have to find something. I got
family.
Okay. Sure. And, of course, the disciples basically are kind of new to this scene at this point. They've just been chosen to come with him. You know, you have to wonder how many people knew who they were. As a matter of fact, I'll back up just a second and say here, so I can't see it on the screen until it pops up. Have to slow down so it can catch time to catch up. Where are Andrew, Peter, and Philip from? Bethsaida. Not too far away, far enough away that they didn't necessarily have to have contact with one another, but they're in Galilee, and they're fishermen, and so that was kind of their business over here. But see, he's chosen these disciples and their fellow Galileans at least. So but Jesus is kind of bringing some extra people, but they say, oh yes, if they're with you, you know, you come on, we know who you are. And so they're welcome to come, but kind of fresh faces in all of this. Might have been a real opportunity for Peter and Andrew and Philip and Nathaniel to meet Jesus' mother and kind of get to know the family a little bit. Of course, his brethren seem to be there too. But all in all, it's a small local affair that goes on in this case. Cana was a small village anyway, and it was a rather obscure affair, something that kind of small and private in a lot of ways. I'm sure they had a decent-sized group there, but it was seeming by invitation, and Jesus was gathered there enjoying the celebration, it seems. He was participating. He's not in any judgment about what they're doing or how they're conducting it. It all seems very fine, and he's, I guess, giving his approval, as best I can tell, by being in the presence of them. The fact that he's there and doesn't leave or pass any kind of comment on this negative about it, it seems like a perfectly good event and something that Jesus participated in. This is a natural, normal activity of human beings, and Jesus is participating in that. I don't know that we get the sense that Jesus had much relaxed time and maybe a happy time, a celebration period, and him being involved in that. This is clearly one of those. Jesus also is being a happy occasion. You know, he really approves, obviously, of the fact that marriage is being conducted at this point. You know, Genesis chapter 2, verses 22 through 25, we read about Adam being presented with Eve and God establishing marriage between them, that this male and female would be joined together, they would become one, and they would be known as a couple at that point. They were one and to be married together. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, the Hebrew writer there says that marriage is honorable in all. And God didn't change his mind about that. The idea of becoming married is an honorable thing. It was designed by God and it was given to the very first man to enjoy in his life. I say that partially because there's so much criticism of somebody like the Apostle Paul not being in favor of marriage, and it seems like a lot of the New Testament, quote-unquote, then teaches against it. But that's simply not true. There were applications that Paul made of the circumstances that they were in at the time. But Jesus very much, and this example alone in Cana, shows that he approves of this, he accepts this, and is celebrating with them in the fact that someone is getting married together, and that's a good thing. Have you thought about that? I think this event really epitomizes the essence of Christ's mission as well. And it's interesting that as he begins to make himself known, and it doesn't seem like he really intended that he was going to make himself known at this specifically besides his local disciples there, but he kind of gets drawn into that a little bit and does yield to some degree. But this event really epitomizes his purpose here in the ministry that he has. He is here as the bridegroom. When he's going there, I can only imagine him sitting there watching this wedding going on and thinking that that's why I'm here and that's my purpose, is to be the bridegroom that will be celebrated. He is ready to be joined with his bride. Think about what John the Baptist says in John chapter 3, verses 28 and 29, and Jason, you teach next, right? Yeah, and Jason will be talking about this next, and we won't go into a lot of detail about it. But in John chapter 3, verses 28 and 29, John says about Jesus, Jason, why don't you read that for me? So this is not just a hyperbole. This is not just an example it's given. John is actually prophesying that this is the purpose that Jesus has come for. He is as the bridegroom to be joined to his bride. Look with me in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 27. This is just a portion of what we normally read here. But the point's not to discuss Ephesians as much as to understand this point at the wedding. Ephesians 5, 25 through 27. Joel, I think I see you there. Would you read that for me? Try not to jam your elbow in Randy's side while you read this. All right, so his job, his mission was to come and prepare his bride and to see her ready for the wedding and then be wed and joined to his bride. The Apostle John uses this even further in Revelation chapter 21. If you turn there with me, please. Revelation 21. John carries this over. Having recorded the marriage feast in Cana, he uses that same picture of Jesus here with his bride. Revelation 21, verse 2, and then verses 9 through 10. Ashley, do you have that? Revelation 21, 2, and then 9 and 10. Verse 9 and 10. So that was Jesus' purpose, and John talks about the fulfillment of that, that the bride adorned for her husband, that the Lamb's wife is the holy city, the New Jerusalem, which is the church. that is being given. And so this carries over a theme through the Apostle John, that he records the wedding feast in Cana. He talks about what John the Baptist had to say regarding Jesus as the bridegroom and how he celebrated that as the best man of the bridegroom. And then John uses that again in the Revelation to describe the church. And we saw that with the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, that Jesus was here to prepare that and make that happen. So very interesting, I think, to draw that essence of Christ's mission there, to become the bridegroom of the bride. Of course, most famously, I guess, at this feast is the performance of the first miracle in the Cana of Galilee, and it is the water to wine. A question has been asked before, is this the first in Cana, or is this the first miracle that he performed at all? And you'll read that quite a bit. And I'll tell you that I don't really know that that matters a whole lot. But the question is this the first miracle in Cana itself, or has it been performing miracles all around? Well, let me share with you one other passage to compare to that may help understand how to explain it. Look at John 4 and verse 54. When he heals the nobleman's son, he is in Cana of Galilee when he does that. Look, John chapter 4, verse 46. So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee where he made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. The nobleman asked for Jesus to heal the son, and he said, your son is healed. And then he goes back and he finds out in Capernaum, his servants meet him on the way and say, your son is healed. And it turned out it was the same time that Jesus had done that. And verse 54 of this, closing out that story, says, this is again the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee. So it doesn't say second miracle in Cana. As a matter of fact, the miracle was actually performed in Capernaum, even though he wasn't actually there. He was in Cana. So if somebody wants to make an argument about it and say, well, the first miracle seemed to be this water into wine in Cana, but it was not necessarily the second miracle that was performed was not the second miracle in Cana, and he's around doing all kinds of things. It seems like maybe he was the second miracle that he did. He's basically rolling these things out kind of slowly, and he is not here to perform miracles. He does that for what purpose? It's a sign of the power of God. The message that he's delivering is from God, that he has the authority to teach the things that he's doing. You have heard it said before, you know it is written, but I say to you, and here's why. You can know that I have the power to tell you these things with authority. So that's why he used miracles. To some degree. Exactly. That's right. Right. Well, in a future lesson, we'll talk about the nobleman's son, but it comes right down to it. Only Jesus and the nobleman actually knew that the whole thing had happened. The disciples with Jesus would have heard him say it. The nobleman finds out later from the people, the servants, that the boy was okay, but they didn't know what Jesus had done. And so it was really just one person besides Jesus who knew about that one either. So it is not the grand scheme of, I'm going to make it rain on everybody and lightning from across the sky. No. These things are actually very small and quiet in a lot of ways, and they build faith in those that know about them. And Jesus is not about performing these wonderful works just for the sake of showing off. Could he have? Yes, he could have. He could have done the great smoke from the mountain and the trumpet sound just like God did for the children of Israel, but that had a purpose too when the people were called together. Jesus does this very quietly. Yeah, and it says clearly this is his first miracle, so I just don't see that there's room for him to have done this around the house. I don't know what she expected him to do, but I guess that was actually one of the questions I was going to ask then. You know, what are the possibilities about what she expected he might do about it? Why does she ask him? The rest of the family's there too. Yes, right. Exactly. What else might she have expected as a mother talking to her son? Say again. To take care of it and go get what she needed, yeah. And I don't really see a reason why she would think up front that he would do something miraculous here. But she's very used to talking to Jesus and asking him as the oldest to go do something. Elijah really relates to this. He's not the oldest necessarily, but he's the oldest that's still in the house most of the time and he gets asked a lot, you know. And when you get responses like that, you keep asking. And Jillian gets all the boys to help, but he will step out. Ansley was, you know, the oldest and the girl, and so she did that a lot. And why? Because when you ask to get something done, you get a full response. You get from Jesus, you get the best. He never lacked. He always was no slacker. He did everything he should have done. And she's very used to getting his help and getting quality work out of it. So if nothing else, I feel like that's right too. A good example is she's very used to asking for his help and expecting to get assistance on this. And if she does bear some responsibility, she's feeling kind of bad for the situation. Maybe that wasn't her job about the wine, but hey, I've got my family here, and I'd be happy to help out and chip in to whatever I can do. And so I'm going to call on Jesus like I've done before. Well, at this time, he answers her in such a way as to kind of put a little bit of a limit. This is not really our affair, and I'm here as a guest. So why are we being involved? Why am I being involved in this? I've got my disciples here, and you know. But he does step up, obviously, to go help, and he's going to take care of it, but not in a grand way and hauling in wine so everybody can see that, yes, the Jesus family, the Mary family, you know, have taken care of this. There were water pots there, and John actually tells us why the water pots were there. Yeah, it was very important to the Jews that they always wash and cleanse themselves before they eat. And of course, Jesus is going to face that many times throughout his ministry, that idea that they weren't following the tradition of the elders. But at a meeting like this, of course, they would have tried to do that. I also read something, and I just want to kind of cut this off for you at the pass a little bit, about how that it says these containers were there, six of them, and they contained two or three firkins apiece. And one said, now the Spirit could have told us exactly how many firkins each one of them held, but it just chose to leave it. What's a better understanding of that? They're different sizes. They're different sizes. Fortunately, the book seemed to imply that. It didn't quite say it, but he implied it. Yes, that there were six pots, and they weren't exactly the same size. So some held 20, some held 30 gallons. That would also indicate that there were probably a decent number of people at this if they needed that much water to be clean. All right? And so Jesus, kind of on the quiet, goes around and tells the servants, fill all those pots with water. And then when they fill them with water, what's his instruction of how to get wine? Dip out and go pour it. And so when they dip it out, you know, they knew what they put in that pot was water. But what ends up in the cup is wine. So who's aware of the miracle? The servants. Maybe Mary, maybe his disciples, if they were paying attention to these things. But it seems mostly that it was just Jesus and those servants. I even liked a portrayal in a movie that I saw that the servants kind of went and dipped the water, and they're going out and kind of tentatively ready to pour this into the glass, you know, because like, why am I serving them water? They want wine. And then, of course, it was wine. And I thought that was a kind of interesting portrayal. They're kind of having to just trust what's being told to them. But Mary had set that up, didn't she? What did she tell the servants? Whatever he tells you to do, you do. It'll be good, it'll work out, and it'll be the right thing if you just do what he says to do. And so they followed that instruction as servants they should have. Changing this water to wine, What meanings could you get out of that? What could you understand about that? Nailed it. Exactly. Thank you. I can't see that it's not exactly that idea. The newness of it, the conversion from the washing away of the body, that attempt to clean, and Jesus' ability to fully cleanse through his blood. And that's at least one of the things you see. I think there's a myriad of connections we can make here. That's got to be at the primary root of all of that Jesus is making something new. He takes something old, the washing of the hands, the cleansing, purification to try to be in good service to the Lord, and makes something new out of it. And then what, when they take it to the governor, then what does the governor judge regarding the quality? This we've had all along, yeah. And this is well into it. You know, it wasn't like they forgot to have the wine. They had wine, and it ran out. So it's been going on for a while, and people have been served. And the governor, the one who's running that, which was apparently not Mary, by the way, in that case, somebody else was actually primarily in charge, gets this and says, this is the best that we've had so far, and gives real kudos to whoever did that, who saves the best for last, right? Well, again, that's Jesus. He is the best for last. The whole old law has been going on for 1,500 years. Man's been around for 4,000 years. But the best comes here at the end of the law, at the close of the law. You see the best blood, the perfect blood, of all the blood of bulls and goats that have been shed. The best blood is about to be shed with the Lamb of God that John has identified. He did. With no one else, it's got to be the bridegroom. And yes. Exactly. The spiritual bridegroom had done this for them. So, you know, they had received the land that they were so proud of, the land of Canaan. They had the nation of Israel that they knew they were special God's people. They had the prophet Moses as their lawgiver. And the sacrifices that they gave were unique in the world at the one temple of the true and living God. But Jesus brings the mansions of heaven as our home. The nation of Christ, of Christians, is the people of God. Jesus is not just a prophet, not just a lawgiver, not just a priest. He is the prophet, priest, and king. He is the best of them all. And he offered the perfect sacrifice, the Lamb of God that doesn't just remember sins, but actually washes them away in this blood. We could go on and on and on with this simple miracle that's done, kind of on the quiet, at this simple marriage feast that takes place in Cana. We're going to have to move on from there, but I want to intrigue you, if I can, just to meditate on this. Keep working on it. Keep reading through the passage and look for these connections and details that we learn about Jesus and his ministry. And I think your faith will be very much uplifted. Yes, I have. And they're naturally going to do that. Look, Jesus is in on it. But he referred in another place that they called him a winebibber. And he was clearly defending himself that he was not. He in no way participated in drunkenness or let that get the best of him. But yes, this is probably one of the most common passages for that. Not only did he drink it, but he made it. And it was the best. So, all right, from Cana, he and the family then, verse 11 of chapter 2, he and the family leave and go to Capernaum. Who all is there? I say his family. Who all is there? And his disciples, right. They went there and they stayed just a few days. Capernaum is the place where he's going to almost call his second home throughout his ministry. So we're going to see Capernaum come up quite a bit. But it would have been common in Galilee, as it's one of the bigger towns. And we also know that the brethren from Bethsaida would have been very familiar with Capernaum as they sailed across the sea and sold the fish that they caught and things like that. It would have been these different communities. And Capernaum was definitely one of the more important ones on the Sea of Galilee for folks. And so they travel from Cana over to Capernaum. That was at least a good solid day. It doesn't say they stopped along the way, but they did go there. And then they rested for a few days and didn't move on. But then it wasn't very long, and they did have to move on. And what was the reason then for leaving Capernaum at this time? Yeah, it's time to go back down to Jerusalem to the Passover. And Jesus never missed this. Excuse me, he never missed this time. They traveled from Capernaum to Jerusalem for the first Passover of his ministry. By far, this is not his first Passover. He's been to 30 of them at this point. Well, at least 29, I guess. But he's been to the Passover, he's been to Jerusalem in the temple many times, and we saw one of those occasions, in particular when he was 12, as well as the statement that he and his family went every year. So they were faithful to do that. So the whole family and his disciples go, and staying for a few days in Capernaum, then they move down to Jerusalem. And we say down because we're looking at the map, but the scripture is very consistent from the Jewish perspective that they always go up to Jerusalem. And you remember that from our geography studies of why they say go up from no matter where they are? Yeah, Jerusalem is the city set on a hill, the city of David. And so they're always going up and giving deference to that as the authority, place of authority, the seat of authority for all Jews, with the temple there and the king of Israel, when they were there, would rule from Jerusalem, the city of David. And so no matter where they were in the land, you talk about going up to Jerusalem. It gave honor to it, but physically you couldn't get there without eventually going up. You had to go up the hill to the heights to get to the city of Jerusalem. And they're going there to celebrate the Passover. And so I'll note again on our page here that this Passover at the bottom of the first page there, first set, is the Passover that we're going to mention here in John chapter 2 and verse 13. Where did most of the Passover take place? Hint. The ceremonies of the Passover were conducted at the temple. And this is a representation of Herod's temple that had been built. So this is kind of supposed to be the New Testament time here. And Jesus, when he comes into the city ready for the Passover there, just like everybody else, he visits the temple. I have to tell you that I always think about Jesus entering the temple at this point and compare that back to when God came to the temple before in the old days. Somebody turn to Exodus chapter 40. Exodus 40 verses 3. Jody, I see you turning there. Let's do you. Exodus 40 verses 34 and 35. And then that's about when Moses set up the tabernacle. And then 1 Kings chapter 8. Verses 10 and 11. Michael, I'll let you do that. You made eye contact with me. 1 Kings 8, 10, and 11, when Solomon dedicated the temple and it was finished with construction. Let's read both of those passages. Exodus 40, 34, and 35. Thank you. All right, and then in Solomon's day for the temple that he built, 1 Kings 8, 10, and 11. All right, so what's consistent in both of those cases for the tabernacle and for the temple when the glory of the Lord appears and fills the place? What do we see in both cases? Even Moses was not able to withstand the presence of the Lord coming in its fullness to these two holy places. All right, well, they're going into the temple now, and Jesus walks into the temple. And brethren, I'm telling you that this is God entering the temple again. I just love that picture that he's walked in. Jesus is not looking around, going, wow, what a place. He has seen it. He's had the bird's eye view for a long, long time. This is his place with his people. But as he walks into the temple this time, what is the atmosphere like regarding his presence? Nope. Any big reactions? Anybody run out, oh, we can't stand to be in here with him. Does anybody even seem to take notice of him? No. God is now walking around. Of course, he made himself like a man, and I'm not trying to downplay that idea. He made himself a man. He made himself like his brother in the seed of Abraham. He is a man living among us. But it's still God walking in this temple. And God, everything that Jesus knows about what has been done here, what has not been done here, what regularly goes on, the camaraderie, the affection that he has for his people, and that he met them and wants to meet them at the mercy seat that is located in this temple. And yet he walks in, and nobody really even takes notice. As a matter of fact, they don't seem to even look up from what they are doing. What do the passages that we read in Exodus and in 1 Kings imply about the space and the place of the temple? the space, this place. What does it imply about this place? God filled it. No, I'm sorry. I'm not talking about a physical description. I'm talking about part of its meaning and such. When they're here, what is implied about these passages that we read? The way God portrayed Himself in these places, the tabernacle first, and then the temple. Holy and special, unique, very very important, a holy place, a place of honor. And as Jesus walks in, He's not looking at the building. And He may be thinking about all the times that He's met the people here, but what does He see? Business, to put it lightly, business being conducted. The Lord's business? He's supposed to be about His Father's business. Is this the business? No. No. He looked around and he sees, like you said, business being conducted. In this picture here, you can see these porticos that are on this outside. This is the outer courtyard. And these porticos here were places where the animals and the money changers could be, especially if it was raining. The weather was not good. They could spread out into this open area if they needed to, but there were coverings for them that people move in and out. And people coming from all over the world would need to exchange their money so that they could give the temple tax in the temple shekel that they were supposed to. I think the Jews actually overread that a little bit, but they took it very literally, surprise, surprise, and they were supposed to give it in a certain form, and so these money changers offered that. Then people came from long distances and didn't have animals with them. They had to procure animals, and there were people there who were more than happy to help them get those together. But they're not focused on the conduct of the service that goes on and the holiness of it. They're trying to figure out how they can make the most profit, and they're in this for business. And it's become a big business, especially at these particular holidays, the Passover, Pentecost later, Ingathering later, the Feast of Tabernacles. When those large crowds came, this was an opportunity. You know, this is Black Friday for them at Passover. Right? They're going to turn that profit. Of course, it was early in their year. So that's what Jesus sees going on around Him. And it really kind of disgusts Him. And we know that because He just seemed to have stepped off to the side for a little bit, gathered up some materials after seeing all this going on with the animals and the money changers, and He made a scourge of small cords. Now, there's a real irony in the fact that He makes this scourge, because He's going to be scourged Himself at some point. But He comes into the temple and makes this scourge to be used. It is not made to damage. It's ropes. It's just kind of long strings. It's not made to damage. It's made to motivate so that He can make His point as He's going around. He's ready to move animals and direct men, and He's going to start driving them out. And it's a very active and controlled violence, but it is somewhat violent. Jesus is very much physically demanding that they change what they're doing. He begins to move the animals to drive them out of the temple, the sheep and the oxen. He uses the scourge to tell people where to go. Again, controlled violence that He's there. He's really demanding that they make a change, that they move out of the way. It says that He poured out the money changers' money and overthrew the tables. It scattered their coins everywhere, so everybody's stuff was all mixed up in this area. And to the dove sellers, He told them, "Take these things out of here. Take them away from this place. Don't have them here." He is taking the authority to tell them, it does not belong here. You take it out. Later on, He does this again near the end of His ministry, 3.5 years from now. And He tells them that they've made it a den of thieves. Well, He felt the same way here. They were making a house of merchandise out of this. But what is Jesus' motivation for this? Does he hate these people? Is he just judging them that they're lost? Pardon me? Cleansing. And what's His motivation for that? His zeal for God. Not His hatred toward the people. Not His anger toward them. It's His zeal for the house of God. Later on, the disciples recognize and understand that that's what drove Him to do this. So He is not lashing out in anger and wrath. He is showing His zeal for the house of the Lord, for the precious, honorable place that this is, that he's been to many times before in his personal life here on the earth, but also in presence with God throughout the ages that the temple has been in existence. Yes. He was. He was. And you notice no one interferes, not even the rulers. They don't interfere. They observe. They see what happens. And a lot of people remember this incident because of the conversation that they have right afterwards. A lot of people remember this, and they remember that he does it again. But John doesn't tell us that Jesus was angry or wrathful about this. His motivation was his zeal for the house of the Lord and the lack of religious fervor among the people that he sees. That they're just conducting business, just making money, going around. Yep, here's your lamb, here's your dove, yep, here's your shekels, make sure you get that in. And it's just a lot of business. And that's not what the temple was supposed to be about. The temple is a house of worship, a house of prayer, a place to commune with God. Well, having done this, of course, then the Jewish authorities come in and they do ask him, you know, what we need a sign. What by what authority do you do this? Show us the sign that you have. Brethren, I'll tell you, I've never really thought about this exactly this way, but when I started to think about how to explain this, it occurred to me that I don't know that they necessarily were seeking a miracle at this point either. I'm not sure people knew to ask about a miracle from Jesus. That maybe the first sign that they're asking for is, what letter do you have from Pilate or someone else? What signet do you carry that says you have the right to come in here and disrupt our worship the way it is? Now, I think that's at least a good possibility. Any thought about that? I mean, if they could pull off a miracle and would explain it, that might have been very convincing. But I don't even know that they would know to ask for that kind of thing. But what is it that gives you the authority to do this? What sign of your authority do you have to show us? So maybe it wasn't miracles. Maybe it was papers or a signet of some kind. But Jesus tells them, I do have a sign for you. I don't know that you're going to accept it, but and they don't. But what is the sign that he gives them for his authority to do this? Yep. Did you notice that it doesn't, and I think I've heard it misquoted too many times, did you notice that it doesn't say, I will tear down this temple and build it in 3 days? He says, you tear down this temple and I will build it in 3 days. You tear down this temple. Well, this building has taken 46 years to be built. And it wasn't done, by the way. They spent the next 30 years actually still completing it. So it was a 75 or 6 year project. It was completed a few months before Rome came in, besieged the city, and took it all the way to destroying it. 46 years it had been in construction at this point. Jesus says, you tear this down, and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. How would you do it? And they're looking around these giant stones and the sheer size of it. How could one man have any effect on it at all? But John tells us, fortunately, he was talking about his body. Isn't it interesting that Jesus doesn't give them any of that at this point? He's, look, you're going to see it later. You're going to see it later. Do they remember this? The disciples remember it later on and realize that he was talking about his body, and John includes that here. Do the Jewish leaders remember that he said this? It's the one thing that they can all agree on he actually said. He said he would tear down this temple and build it in 3 days. Okay, first of all, he didn't say that. So that was a misquote. Maybe that's where everybody gets it. Let's quote the Jewish leaders. Let's quote John and what Jesus said. And so finally somebody started putting things together, right? Yeah. But yeah, this is really highly memorable, and it seems like maybe a small incident in the gospel as we go through this, but they do remember it. And later on, the disciples remember it and understand that he was talking about his body. And, oh, this was an early prophecy of a sacrifice that he was going to make. And he stayed in the tomb for 3 days before he was raised up again. He kind of just leaves it at that. And he doesn't try to convince the leaders any more of this. He's got a lot more to say to them than this. But you can tell they don't ask him any more about it either. They don't inquire, what could you possibly mean? This thing's taken 46 years. So that's ridiculous. So what do you mean? They never asked that question. And so Jesus didn't volunteer more information. They just let it sound like a lunatic was answering their or not answering their question, you might say. Yeah, they don't see it that way. Jesus, though, began to teach and to preach around this, and he's in and out of the temple. I always wonder, every time he came in the temple after that, did they think he was about to start messing everything up again? And then finally, 3.5 years later, that he can wait a long time, you know, before he lets on. Wondering if he'd do it. He's in and out of Jerusalem several times with the Passover, the feast day here. He teaches and they believe in his name, verse 23 says. They believe in his name when they saw the miracles which he did. So now the miracles are starting to become more prolific for the purpose of affirming the word that he's saying. But notice that it says in verse 24, Jesus did not commit himself unto them because he knew all men. This was not the time to lay hold of the response that he was getting as the end-all response that the Jews would give. Especially here in Jerusalem and Judea, they're very fickle about it. They are desperate for a Messiah. They are desperate for a king who will rule them rather than Rome or any other power. They are desperate for that. And when Jesus can do these things, oh, let's make him king. Let's do that. But Jesus didn't just accept that these are now fully true, faithful disciples who will stay with me forever. And they're sure enough going to live down to his expectations at this point, that they're fickle and that they're easily swayed. He feels just as concerned that they're easily swayed to him as they will be swayed against him. And they prove that later on. So Jesus is very wise to not think that this is the substance of my ministry. I am fully successful. I have arrived. I'm so glad this has gotten done. He doesn't feel that at all. This is the beginnings. This is the beginnings. And he's getting a good response, but there is a lot more to come. I was really hoping we would make it to that point today, and I'm glad we did, because Wednesday night we'll be spending our time pretty much exclusively on the conversation with Nicodemus, and I think there's plenty to talk about there. So I appreciate your comments and your participation this morning, and look forward to the rest of our study Wednesday night, the Lord willing.